Look, Matt.
Where? Oh, I see. Wow.
Oh, my.
Oh, and look over there.
Wow, is that culture?
Oh,
yes.
My goodness. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Las Culturistas.
Ding dong. Las Culturistas calling.
Want to get out ahead of this?
Sure.
A straight wedding took my voice this week.
Yep.
It has not. The universe has not yet given it back, but I look forward to the day when I sound like me again.
Well, I was just talking to you about hours ago, and vocally you were even more shot than you are now. And I really have to commend your recovery and the human body is amazing.
Isn't the body one of the most amazing things? Actually, it's a rule of culture. What number is this again?
91.
91.
The human body is amazing.
It's one of the most amazing things in the world.
Talk to us about what brought you to this place.
Well, I sort of like was at a straight wedding on Long Island with all my high school friends. And so that you can sort of fill in the blanks there. I ended up sort of wasted drinking tequila on the rocks with my high school friends at a Marriott at 2 a.m. So that was how that went.
I'm so happy for you that you're able to do this, because I think, I don't know if I'm speaking for, I should just speak for myself. I will speak for myself.
Do not speak for me.
I won't speak for you or anyone listening. No. I couldn't do that. With people from high school who I haven't kept up with in a while, like there are just so many cobwebs, gossamer threads that we'd have to, you know, just sort of try to dust off. And look, alcohol is a wonderful social lubricant, as we all know, but I just think...
Great lube.
I just would still be
the gun oil of non-sexual lubricants, I would say.
Oh my God. Gun oil is sexual, though. What are you saying?
So I would say that...
alcohol is non-sexual. Well, don't...
And sort of what I'm saying there is that gun oil is the lube I use, okay? So that's a breadcrumb for the readers.
Alcohol could be considered a sexual lubricant.
In many ways, Bowen. And that's why I stan you so. Is because you're always thinking outside the box. You have sort of one of those most subversive queer comedy minds. And that's what shoots you to the top. For your consideration, the semi-season, Bowen Yang.
Oh,
everyone, I know you got your ballots in hand.
It makes me deeply uncomfortable that you talk about this every episode now.
It's funny, and I think it's going to happen.
I don't want to talk. It makes me so uncomfortable to think about.
Yeah, you look really uncomfortable. I'm on the ballot too. It'll never happen for me. For the show,
everyone,
Hot Dog.
For your consideration, Matt Rogers. Hot Dog. The billboards are everywhere in Los Angeles.
Everywhere. My For Your Consideration ads are so annoying. It's like, we get it. I do want to also shout out, you know, the human body is amazing. You know what else is amazing?
What?
Medicine. Because I am on a steroid right now that allows me to speak to you.
My God. And you got the prescription straight away?
He didn't even give me a prescription. I'm going to say it. Hot, straight doctor at the City MD. And you know I'm on record as not being about City MDs, aka they're like an antibiotic candy store. So I basically was like waiting for him to say...
They're a chain restaurant, yeah.
They're a chain restaurant.
Yeah.
But what I'm waiting for him to say, here is an antibiotic. Here's a Z-Pack. I don't even really need... I'm not even going to look you in the eyes once. Just here's a Z-Pack. Throw it at me and get the fuck out of here. They gave me a shot of a steroid. It was a Gatorade... I don't know how to describe it. It was like a shot of Gatorade and there was a steroid in it. And I took it.
God.
And now I'm on a steroid.
How does it feel?
Fucking fabulous.
And he just flexed.
Speaking of steroids and being gay, we want to... I'm not saying anything about this NFL player, but we want to congratulate this openly gay NFL player.
What's his name?
Carl Gellib.
I didn't really... I said good for him. I guess... But doesn't this feel like... I'm having deja vu to Colton Underwood in a way. They're not the same. They're not the same person. It's not the same situation at all. I'm like...
Are they not?
I don't know. I mean, until Carl does like my favorite Amazon products to help me feel pride. Like
that was the funniest shit I've read in years.
Hold on. What did it say? Hold on.
He was like, what are your favorite Amazon buys? And we should say, I did text our group that about it and Bowen immediately said, unfortunately, a publicist wrote this. But I do, which very illuminating for me. Good job, Bowen, seeing all the Pepsi cans as it were. But,
yes. Oh, no. My go-to water bottle is Voss. These are great for me when I'm entertaining or when I have guests over.
Voss water bottles are great for me when I'm entertaining or having guests over. So we can say that sometimes when he has guests over, he's not really entertaining. Ba-boom.
Sure, wow. Boring bitch. Okay. Reebok Club C 85 Pride Shoes. There's nothing better than a fresh pair of white sneakers. And these are
nothing better.
And these are the Reebok Pride shoes. I like them not only because they're white, but because they've got a little pop and a little flare. And that's essentially me. I like to be clean, but also have a little flare and a little dazzle. These are great shoes. I mean, it's a haiku. It's wonderful.
It's poetry for sure.
It's poetry.
Yeah.
To end on, these are great shoes is inspiring.
These are great shoes.
He said, I love these because they're white. And that's a brave thing to say.
As they say, the world over.
You know, we both had very straight weeks. You had a straight wedding, seeing a hot straight doctor. Me being in what I think is maybe the straightest city in America. No, that's not true. I was going to say it's Savannah, Georgia, but there's a very gay story that happens there, which is Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. But I mean, otherwise, it's Bachelorette Party Central. It's Bachelor Party Central, and therefore, I would say it is a very hetero city. It was very nice. Was there with my sister, my parents, my nieces, my brother-in-law. Stressful to eat out every single meal with two children, I will say. Two young children, but it was a lovely time. It was, you know, my sister had a nice escape from Atlanta, and my brother-in-law, they were due for one. The kids were due for one. It was nice for the whole family to be together since the pandemic. All I'm saying is I don't think I love Savannah, unfortunately, and I do have to be public about that.
Well, you gave it a shot.
I really gave it a shot.
Well, you'll try anything once.
I took the ghost tours. I learned all about the bodies that are buried under every square. I learned about the Mercer Williams house, of course. I learned about the ghost of Flannery O'Connor, the racist ghost of Flannery O'Connor haunting a house.
Yeah.
All of these things I loved. I just don't think it's the city for me, and that's okay. I think I need to start recusing myself from a narrative of every city in America is a good city, which cannot possibly be true. Because if every city is good, then no city is good. Do you know what I'm saying?
Then everyone would live in every city. It'd simply be chaos, and we all know that's not the case. Oh, I understand. You understand. But I think it's great that we sort of got some straight going during Pride Month, because the weekend of Pride is upon us.
I got it out of my system, and this is going to be a stressful week, but we're strapping ourselves in.
And the straightness ends right now with this episode. I'm telling you that right now.
The straightness ends right now, especially while we bring in our guest. I can't really believe the guest. Do you know what I mean?
I get exactly what you mean. I can't believe the guest.
Do you know? But like when I say the words, I can't believe our guest. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I sort of remember us sort of, I guess you'd say, starting this podcast years ago and thinking, we'll never get a guest like insert name of guest here.
Our guest's name. He's had probably as prolific of a career as you could want. Is an exercise in futility to name all the credits and think, oh yes, we've encapsulated this whole man's career. We're not going to do that, but he's otherwise a bon vivant, a man about town, about the world, owns the wonderful club Coming in the East Village.
To say that that place is your place, the power.
Oh my God.
I stomped the boards of Club Coming many a time. People might remember in the great before, I was Catherine Cohen's sub. Whenever she wasn't there, I was there. And it wasn't called Cabernet Cabaret. It was called Grigio Gig. I got it going. And I think Alan Cumming would have been very proud.
He would have been very proud. And look, it's back. We encourage everyone who is in New York City, if you're visiting, if you live here, to go give it a visit. Wonderful shows happening every night. Wonderful bar experience. He's also the director of the new Audible original Hot White Heist with an all-star queer cast, including Cynthia Nixon, MJ Rodriguez, Bianca Del Rio, Jane Lynch, Tony Kushner,
starring
Jonathan Bowen Bailey,
Yang.
Katya Zamolskova.
I can say it because Bowen will just Cameron keep going with this sentence as if he's not in it. But I can
and me,
say
it. I'm in
it's, it. It's led by Bowen Yang, who is a talent, a queer talent. But the queerness, he supersedes it. You know what I mean? He's international. International star.
Wow. Thank you. And who else would be an international star, if not me, would be our guest. Everyone, please welcome into your ears.
Jesus Christ.
Alan Cumming!
Alan.
Thank you, boys. Hello, Bowen Yang and Matt Rogers.
We were talking before about how good it is to hear him say your name, and then he said my full name for the first time, and oh boy, it was like a damn bath.
It's worth the wait. You're joining us from an opal mine. Tell the listeners, the readers, where you're from.
Where
you're coming from. Yeah,
I'm in Australia, in South Australia. I'm in Adelaide. I'm an artistic director of the Adelaide Cabaret Festival, So I'm doing sort of pop-up club Cummings, actually. It's such fun. Ah. DJ, and then we have performers, and it's such fun. And then I'm doing my own concert show at the end of the festival. But I came here to this place called Cooper PD. And ironically, I just did Anderson Cooper's show before you guys.
Irony.
And but it's called Cooper with a B. And it's an old opal mining town. And everybody lives underground because it's so hot in the summer. So I'm actually in a hotel that is underground. And you just see these little kind of funny poles sticking out. Everywhere, and that means there's a little air hole going down to some little person. There's 17, I know all the facts, there's 1700 people live in this town. 70% of them live under fucking ground.
That's insane.
There's an element of danger here. There's an element of danger. What's do you feel safe?
I'll see. Well, the thing is, I can go out into my corridor and look left and I can see daylight. So it's not, okay. I don't feel quite so bad. But that's unusual. Yesterday, I was in an opal mine. I was in an opal shop. I mean, an underground mine, sorry, an underground shop, an underground cafe, an underground cinema. I did the whole thing. An underground church, an underground Serbian church.
This is a whole, it's a city of moles.
It's just so weird. There was a weird Serbian priest ranting at this little Italian man who was a tourist, telling him who, what do you call him, Leonardo da Vinci was. I nearly
intervened. He didn't know?
I don't know. He couldn't get a word in edgeways. And I just was like, I was about to say, leave the boy alone.
Yeah, leave the boy alone.
Let him be. But they kind of wandered off. But it's been crazy. Like, you know, they shot a part of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert here. It's got that weird outback sort of an industry town where the industry's kind of almost gone and they're sort of pushing the tourist thing. It's just a mishmash of crazy. Oh. I love it.
So then the history and the culture doesn't reach down there, and that's why this person didn't know Leonardo da Vinci. You can't blame him.
Well, yeah, Italy. He was from Italy. He was a little Italian.
That's the thing. I was like, he's a little Italian boy. And if little Italian boys nowadays don't know Leonardo da Vinci, we've lost something as a culture.
If the little Italian boys today know Luca better than da Vinci, there's something wrong in the
there's
culture.
There's something wrong.
Showbiz. Did you see who won the Eurovision Song Contest this year?
It was Italy, wasn't it?
It was Italy with a song, with a sort of rock and roll song. And the man snorted a line of coke off the table, apparently, allegedly. And my favorite thing is when he came to, you know, when they come to win the Eurovision Song Contest, they have to say something to the world. Yes. And he went, rock and roll never dies.
He was right. What do you think of sort of like Eurovision sort of, or because I'm imagining you're a fan, Eurovision's pivot to sort of not honoring pop music as of late, it feels.
Well, I think that was just, I think that's more like the Italian one obviously was a freak. I think it's the fact that the public get to vote now.
Right.
And
I don't
frankly,
love that.
I think that's wrong. I don't think they should. I think it should be the weird little judges.
Yeah.
And because like the weird little judges voted that little Austrian, cute Austrian boy with the sort of falsetto, which is much more what I think of as a Eurovision winner.
Yes.
And then the general public block voted for the Italian rocker alleged cokeheads. So I don't know. I'm a big fan of Eurovision. I grew up with it. I'm very influenced by it. I think in my eclecticism and my, you know, lack of respect for sort of normal pop groups. I think you should always have some quirk. And also my embrace of tacky pop songs. That's my thing. I keep saying this to people in Australia. And at Club Cumming, one of my things about getting older, you know, in my 50s, I became a DJ and a barman part-time. And I think both those things are about, as you were saying about the lubricant, it's both those things are my ways of encouraging people to let go and just have fun and not care what people think and be judged. And so I think, like, for example, I put on some Eurovision hits during my DJ sets in Adelaide, and I like it when people just let go and dance. They're actually in Australia, they're good at letting go. America, not so much.
And what about in the UK?
In the UK, better. They're better, yeah. Because they like the whole sort of thing of Eurovision is quite a good sort of metaphor for it. And also, like, you know, pantomime that we have at Christmas time, where the concept of drag and cross dressing and things like that, or gender play is much more. So those things are more in the mainstream culture, and I think that helps people. They don't feel that they're going to be judged for being too sissy or whatever, you know, for when they dance to certain songs. So Americans are the struggle. They're the challenge.
It does feel like the pop, when I was growing up and like discovering like even like the late night, like Graham Norton and, you know, everything like that. I was always envious growing up here that the pop culture seemed gayer. Like it all just seemed like a lot more flamboyant. And then, you know, as you get older and you understand like, you know, the government in England and everything like that, it is very rather conservative. So I think like it's probably, it probably feels, maybe it's the grass is greener thing. I don't know.
I think it is that, but I, no, I think you're absolutely right. It is gayer. It means it's queerer. Mm. So it means, you know, queerness is more in the mainstream of culture. Also, and I just think that's something that's, yes, it's a conservative government, but I think over the years, just in our, you know, as like, I guess, I mean, maybe from Shakespeare's time, the concept of men dressing up as women, maybe it comes from that, you know, that that's partly, I'm sure that's helped. But even with race as well, like we often watch, you know, I've got one of those, oh, I shouldn't say this, it's not allowed, but you know, those things that you can pretend to be somewhere else when you're not, the sort of VPN things. It gives you a fake IP address. As everyone has.
Oh, you're so scared about talking about VPNs? Ooh, Alan.
Dangerous. Now we know how to, probe with danger here.
Well, anyway, I watch BBC iPlayer and you know, British shows quite a lot. Mm. And it's so fascinating in the commercials. Grant, my husband, he was really remarking on this, that how much more integrated race is as a concept. Like it's not like here when in America, rather, when it feels like, oh, here's the black people commercial. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Here, oh, we're doing, there's some Asian people in this commercial now. Whereas in Britain, it genuinely feels like this is, there's, it's just all mixed and it's just like, it's much more, I think we've gone, we're sort of post trying to be, make a point about it. And it's just actually reflective of the culture. And I think, I think that's the same with queerness as well, actually.
In terms of it being more integrated there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anytime, in terms of like, let's just say racial diversity, it's like anytime there's a, you're presented with the image of a group of people like on a college campus sitting together and it's all different races.
Yes.
Like there's something about that presentation that suggests that it is forced in a way, or that it is underlining how diverse this is.
It's
in a
way that conscious. It's
like, but wait, this kind of, yes. And it's too aware of itself. And so therefore it sort of breaks, it sort of defeats the whole purpose of like, touting
you
what
don't
it's
believe
supposed
it.
To represent. Yeah. Right, right.
But I think that's a lot of stuff in America that people do, you know, it's interesting being away from it a little bit and looking and thinking that, you know, there's a sort of way that people know that they, and that's what was interesting about the past 4 years is that we sort of know how we're supposed to behave or how we're expected to behave and what is proper. But actually, a lot of the time we're paying lip service to it. And that, and you know, during Trump, that changed and people didn't pay lip service to it anymore. So I think it's good that we push these things because obviously there's a long way to go and there's a lot of danger ahead potentially. But I think we have to find a better way of doing it so that it doesn't feel disingenuous, like you're saying.
It's actually funny because like, literally, like right before we got on, I realized there's a connection between this week's episode and last week's episode, which is we had Busy Phillips on, who's obviously the best friend of Michelle Williams. And I was telling her that I saw opening night of when you guys did the revival.
Yeah,
I was there. And so I saw you just absolutely, I mean, your performance of a lifetime, et cetera. You've heard it win the Tony Award. Come on now, all of that. But you truly were stunning. But I was thinking about how I really actually did not know. I said to Sudi, who I went with, I was really bad. I didn't understand, because I think I had only seen the movie Cabaret once when I was younger. And so I didn't really understand that it was going to be as dark as it was and as sad as it was and as about Nazis as it was, to be honest with you. And so I was thinking after, like, you know, obviously that musical depicts a culture that is very liberal and like sort of, you know, seems to be extremely progressive and free. And then the darkness is right around the corner. So I just, that's such an interesting thing that it's been a part of like such iconic work that you've done too, that very
thing. Well, yes, I think I've done, you know, and other things I've done as well, actually, that are about, I feel my thing is like, don't, and I always say this, I just was talking about Pride with Anderson Cooper prior, sorry to keep name dropping. But
well, we don't know who that is.
We don't
know. So. Yeah, we're not familiar with her.
He and I are part of the Silver Fox Mafia. We're taking over the world. But we're about how I feel you've got to be vigilant, you know, that because it is, we are perilous. We're in a perilous situation. Sure, great strides have been made. But look how quickly it happened with Trump, when all of a sudden trans people are the devil and all these things, and you know, and look, all these things have happened and our rights are being eroded, were being eroded in many ways, and it's a struggle to get them back. And I think that's the fact that that was, and you know, if he'd got in again, I am I was getting death threats by the end of the campaign, you know, regularly on Instagram and stuff for posting anti-Trump stuff. And I started to feel scared. And I, if he got in again, I don't think I would have lived in America anymore.
Mm-hmm. It would have been very hard. Yeah. I mean, it really did get to that point where it felt like it could be the end of the world there. Yeah.
Totally. And it could be easily like, it's us now. You know, that thing, definitely that he hadn't been virulently homophobic, but it was definitely obviously on the cards. Anyway, we've got to be vigilant. And I think a lot of the work I've done is about that, about sort of celebrate. Here's the situation. Oh, but look how much it hasn't changed. I did a movie called Any Day Now about a gay couple in the 70s trying to adopt this little Down syndrome child. And that was about, like, it was a beautiful film, but it was also when we came to do it, to promote it, I was like, well, you know, it hasn't got that much easier. You try adopting a child in this state adoption system when you're queer these days. It's, you know, there's lots of gay people with kids. Luckily, they can afford to have a surrogate or go a different route. And mm-hmm. so we just have to be vigilant and not rest on our laurels. And I think that's what I slightly worry about pride as well. That it's like, hurrah, hurrah. And actually you think, you know, maybe we should hope for the day when we don't need pride.
Yeah.
Sure. Between me and Matt and our friends, we've all talked about how the meaning of it or the whole ceremony around it is just changes over time and every year. And it's like, what does pride even mean? Like, I mean, like, exactly. I remember a time when pride was, for me, it was literally about like, oh my God, like, this is like the first time I'm seeing like queer people together, you know, like, and now and it's like such.
Yes, but that's what it's good for. And that's why, you know, old, you know, assholes like me should stop saying things like that, because it's for people who don't have the outlet to do that. And I think that's great. I have a chance to do it. And I went on a gay cruise, I performed on a gay cruise, and it was the most crazy thing I've ever done. It was like a bath. Like, I had to go down the stairs to the stage. I kind of got on in St. Lucia, and they'd all been on for like about 5 days. And I got taken down to where the stage was. And it was all through the lower floors cabins. Uh-huh. And it was like on every door, it was almost like their grinder profile on every door. And the doors open and little hints of what you might see when you went in. Photographs.
Like the red light district bomb the ocean.
Totally. It was hilarious. And I was a bit like, oh my God, just trying to get to the stage. Anyway, I did my concerts. And then what I thought was lovely about it was that there was people on that boat from all parts of America who don't have bar, who don't live in New York and can't go to a bar that you can, you know, whatever can happen in the back room, or they don't have that, those kind of options.
Right.
And so it was so exciting and liberating for them to be on that boat and to feel safe to be able to do all that. And I think that's what pride is good for. But I think my overall worry is about that, obviously the corporation, the corporate sort of takeover of it, and the fact that people think, oh, that's fine, we've done pride now, we've done the queers, we've done our service to the queers this year, we've all put on a rainbow hat and got drunk. And I feel that's my worry, that kind of diminishes or perhaps impedes our progress.
Sure. Are you experiencing any FOMO at all of New York? Like, are you like at all like experiencing any anxiety from being away from New York this particular summer?
Not really, because I'm having such fun. I mean, I'm basically doing New York, and I'm doing club coming in. I'm dressed in a monkey suit, dancing around to tacky pop songs, banging drumsticks, and, you know, bringing people. There's such great performers here that are hilarious. Do you know Hans? Remember Hans the German who was on American Idol? He's this Australian man who dresses up as a sort of in lederhosen and glitter. And he lives in Adelaide, so he's been doing great things. He actually did with Henry. They did a Tchaikovsky Britney Spears accordion mashup.
Oh my God!
I have to say that is the most Henrik thing I've ever heard.
I know,
and we have to tell the readers because they're going to be so excited to know. So Henry is obviously a dear friend of the show.
We love
and
Henry.
A beloved ex boyfriend of mine, but dear close friend, also my musical director as well. But he's with you there. You said he's on the other side of that opal wall.
Yes, he's come with me to the Opal place, to Cooper PD. So he's like just a door down, and we're waiting for me to finish this so we can go on this plane. But he's my musical director and he does like for my concert, but also he's the musical director, and we have a band at Club Cumming in the Spiegel tent. And what I love is, my favorite thing is I DJ, and then the band plays along, and I just dance around, and I dance for like hours on end, and often in a rabbit suit, often different suits, and then, you know, stuff like that is such fun. So I actually don't have FOMO about New York.
Good.
Because I feel I'm getting my fill here. And I love when I see the pictures from Club Cumming. But I'm actually pretty sated. But it'll be nice to get back.
You know, I often think that having fun is a choice. And I have a feeling about you that you make that choice to have fun a lot.
A lot.
Totally, Matt. I absolutely do. And I think it's really interesting. I think happiness is a choice, actually. I really do. And I think, I mean, not that I dismiss any kind of
rough course
depression or mental illness. I've suffered that myself hugely in the past, but I actually, yeah, I definitely feel I've made a choice to live. You know, I always say this is slightly sort of Hallmark cards kind of thing, but it's true that like I have great access to darkness, mm-hmm. but I choose to stand in the light. And I think that darkness helps me in my work a lot. But, you know, that's why I don't really like actors. I mean, I don't really like hanging out with actors, you know, because they talk about acting all the time. And I find that just immensely boring. I'd rather just do it and go home.
Yeah.
Go out and have fun. Years ago, I did this play, Bent. Do you know that play? It's about gay people
I've heard of the play. Yeah. I can't say I know it, but I know of it.
It's an amazing play by Martin Sherman. And actually, in a funny way, he actually kind of brought to the world's attention the fate and the lot of queer people under Nazism. Like, and this is a play about a man going to a concentration camp and pretending to be Jewish because he'll get treated better if he's Jewish than if he's gay. And it doesn't end well. It's a really bleak play. I did this in London a few years ago, and I made a point of, and it was all these boys, it was totally all men cast, lots of Nazis and blah 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 and horrible. And I, it was me and this other boy with the people in the concentration camp. And I just knew if I did not like leave it behind and have fun, I would go demented. So I did. Yeah. I actually had the best time, even though it was the bleakest, most despairing thing to do. I finished the play and I walked off stage and I was like, give me a drink. Where are we going? And we all had really, and I think that's really important to do that.
I've heard that a lot. Yeah. That about people that do dark work, that they need to, they need to have aggressive fun while they're doing it.
Absolutely. I remember Joan Collins, if I may drop another name, you know who told me
you
not
may.
To name drop?
Yes,
Bobby De Niro. Joan Collins said, Joan Collins came to see it. She said, Alan, how do you do this every evening? How do you go through it? I said, by not talking about it afterwards, Joan.
Yeah.
Said, no, but how do you do it? I said, Joan, by not talking about it afterwards. So immediately I was like, don't want to discuss this. You've seen it. Obviously, it's harrowing. Obviously, it's like really insane. But now I'm not doing that anymore. And I think it's like that thing about you have to choose. You have to also, you can choose to have fun. You can choose to have happiness. You have to choose when you're not working as well. And I think that's something like, you know, like last night in this little place in the middle of nowhere, like people came up to me during dinner and I was like, oh, no, I'm not going to take a photo. I'm actually just having dinner with my friend. Like, and you can say it in a nice way that means that it's just not an appropriate time for this to happen.
Of course. Oh my gosh.
I always say that. I always say to people, I'm not going to take a photo of you because if I took a photo with you, everyone would see and then everyone would want one and I'd have to do this all night long.
Yeah.
Thanks. It's so lovely to meet you. And they're like, oh, of course, Alan, of course. And it's actually just taking the time to explain it to them and be nice and people really get it.
That's beautiful. And I of course, this is like a time honed thing that you have like developed over the course of your career.
Right.
It's like you know how to like relay this information to these people.
Yes. And it's just, and the biggest thing, I always think of my mom, because it's just like, just be nice. It doesn't cost anything to be nice. And actually, there's no situation that works less well than when you are nice in it. So.
You told me this story when we were recording Hot White Heist of when you, am I allowed to say this?
Well, what is it?
When you and a certain actor on a certain movie went to a nude beach.
Oh, yes, you can say that.
Okay, because this is, I feel like you are inheriting something from Siri and McKellen.
Yes.
When you guys were shooting X2.
Yes.
Where were you? Like, it was like Germany or something? Or was
No, it was Canada, in Vancouver.
Canada, it was Vancouver. And then, okay, so then you guys just, you know, tell the story. I love this story.
And the thing is, like, he came on my podcast that you did recently, Alan Cumming Shells, and we talked about it because the thing, each week I have a thing, you know, that I take from my shelves. And the thing that actually, there was two things. The thing, one of the things was a little dog necklace made from hemp that he'd bought for my dog at this nudist beach. And the other thing was a little bracelet that had my name on it, that a film that we were working on, another film actually, the daughter of the director, I was making beads with her one day and her mum said, oh, she's finished the necklace and she wants to give it to you, but she spelt your name wrong. I was like, oh, that's charming, even more. It said anal instead of Aaron on it. Anyway, this Ian story was we were shooting X-Men and I always think of Ian McKellen as like, a 14-year-old girl trapped inside an 80-year-old man's body. I mean, And he said to me, you know, we're living quite close to each other on this place called oh, I can't remember. What was it called? Never mind. And but it was near the beach, and further along to the west was a nudist beach. Like, that you had to, and he said to me, "Oh, apparently there's an, I just read in the newspaper there's a nudist beach." No, I said, "Oh yeah, that's right. It's called Wreck Beach. I've read about, I heard about it too. Yeah, yeah. Oh yes, yes, yes." Couple of days later. Oh, apparently I read this thing about a nudist beach. I said, yes, I said, you said that the other day.
And you wanted to go.
Yeah, and then eventually it was like, oh, well, someone told me they'd been to this nudist beach. I said, do you want to go to the nudist beach? And then he went, well, if you want to go, Alan, I'll go with you like that. I was like, let's go. So we go, and you have to walk down this lovely sort of verdant little path. And then you come to this lovely beach, and there's all like big, you know, tree trunks have washed up on it, and you can sit against them. And Ian went in the podcast, he was going, and I went down there and no one had a stitch of clothing on. I was like, no, it's a nudist beach. And so we got naked, and he just had a little sort of like a little hat that like cricket umpires wear, you know, one of those little straw hats.
Yeah.
So I've got my dog. We're walking along, me and him. And it's so funny because when you're naked and you get recognized, it's a really funny thing because people look at your face and then they immediately drop their heads down to look at your junk. You know, it's immediate. And it's sort of, it's hilarious. And Ian was like, hello, everybody. I said, it's Gandalf. He was like that. Absolutely loving it. And then there was a guy came to sell us little pipes. You know, there was all you could buy pot cookies and everything. And this man had made homemade pipes on a piece of string around his waist, and he was naked. Ian and I were sitting down, and Ian was like, "Can I see that one?" And so the guy's coming close, he's at penis level to our faces. And I'm like, "Ah." And Ian's like, "Oh, it's a lovely one. Do you like that one, Alan?" I'm like, "No, it's like that. Don't buy it." It was such a gas.
That is so funny.
I think that's a great story because it makes me think, oh wow, Alan Cumming and Ian McKellen were these two gay actors on set for this like big blockbuster movie back in a time when, like, I don't know, like, I mean, I don't know
there
that
this so was many,
the,
yeah,
well, there weren't so many, and that this wasn't really part of the conversation. I mean, I'm not talking about this in terms of like a representation thing. I'm just saying, like, there's just obviously there's a shorthand when you run into another queer person in a work environment like that.
Yeah, totally.
And just, I don't know, like what was it like for you guys?
Well, it was that was the gayest film I've ever been on, actually. Because, you know, it was
X2?
X2 is fucking amazing, it's by amazing. The way. It is the crown jewel. And
it's
y'all
incredible.
Are so good in it, too. And it is,
Thank you so much.
Inherently queer because of its X-Men.
It's an allegory of queerness.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Mm-hmm. All the little mutants sing. And there's even a scene where he sort of has to come out as a mutant to his mum.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Bryan Singer, and there was some other people, the writers and everything. It was a very, aside from the actual content of it, had a very queer sort of sensibility. But I mean, I think now, like, you know, like telling that story now, it's got such a different thing. It's like, ah, ha, ha, you know, quirky Alan, quirky Ian. Whereas then it would have been a bit more like subversive, weird, or what they're doing. That's kind of, we don't, you know, that's changed. The way that I think people, and even I think the way that people understand queerness and understand even things like, you know, about monogamy and stuff or lack of in the queer community and how there's different rules and relationships, that I think is much more prevalent now, that idea and just like that concept. And I think, and in a funny way, I think, you know, when all the marriage equality thing happened, one of the things I said in a statement was, I think actually queer people have a lot to teach straight people about relationships and about how to maneuver them. Mm-hmm, and I think that's true. I still do. I think that's very true.
They would be a lot happier if they let go of the whole idea of, because it is a very patriarchal, they're in a prison. I mean, really, I think that there's a lot of unhappiness, especially amongst, like, you know, that like baby boomer generation in America, because, and I think there's a lot of alcoholism because of it. I think there's a lot of like repression in that.
Totally.
And that demographic, because they're too married, literally, to an idea that's not.
And they've been fed this thing that, my thing I think is really awful, I think is awful, is that one thing, one, whatever you call it, indiscretion, or one part of, one way you failed in this vow, because in this pact, that's basically what it's saying.
Right.
If you fail at all, then the whole pact is over. Like, I remember when my brother got divorced the first time, and it basically, when I, you know, I was like, what? So what, you kind of, something happened one night when you were away, and for one, you know, and then your whole life crumbles.
Yeah, the union is over now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I think that's the thing, that's what, that is so damaging. And so what happens, of course, is people just repress it and do it and lie. And, you know, that I think is much worse ways of betrayal than actually discussing how you feel about that, the notion of it happening, and how you'll all gather together again after it happens and be fine with it happening. I just think that's, they're fed this Hollywood ending of, mm-hmm. of how life should be. And we everybody knows that's a lot of shit, yet they continue to buy into it. It's remarkable. Yeah.
It's weird, the indulgences that are allowed. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just, it's when right. you take, if everyone were to take a step back and look at it all, it would look odd because it's odd.
I know. And I think that's what I thought was so great about Hot White Houseboat and bringing it back to Bo and Yang is that Anne Adam, our dear friend Adam Goldman, who wrote
it
manages to get so many issues, I suppose you'd call them, but so many, like the you know, queer people not being monogamous, I would say mostly, or it's much more of a comfortable concept to talk about in queer culture. Like putting things like that and other kind of, you know, queer life things into a very funny script, very casually and not clunkily. Mm-hmm. I thought he did such a good job of that.
I can't believe how I've listened back to it a couple times, to be honest. And I don't ever do this with my own things. Mm. Especially, I mean, okay, this is just me saying this. And this is something that Adam keeps pointing out to me. He's like, no, Bowen, you're in every scene.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, right. Like I'm really, this is the first thing that I've done where I've like really like anchored something. And I should just say that like producing, making like a scripted podcast, like I just think the word podcast kind of frivolizes the whole thing, because it is not an easy thing to do, you know.
It's just huge, like the sound design and the, you know, and it's like it's all these things happening on a train and you're going on top of a carriage and it's a huge, or it's like, I mean, it felt to me like I've made some films before. I've never done anything like this. I did not expect it to be anywhere as detailed and as sort of such high production values as it did, because
likewise,
that's the world we live in. And I think it's excellent. There was that guy, Jeremy, was such a genius. He was
genius. Yeah.
Sweetheart.
Our sound designer. But but I would leave those days sometimes and be like, oh my God, that was a long day. Like that was a lot of work. And Alan like really directed me in such a perfect way. Because Alan, do you remember? So the first day, so Matt, you'll like this and hate this. The first day, the first scene we do a couple takes of this one scene, and then Alan's like really like giving me these great notes, and then at one point he's just kind of like figuring out what he wants to, how he wants to present the note. And then in a lull, I go, you know, you can just give me the line read if you want. It's just like the way everyone does it at SNL. And then Alan like very politely chuckles and he goes, oh, that's okay. And like proceeds to do his job, which is to direct me. And he's just like actually like giving me the space, respecting the process enough and respecting me enough to be like, no, I'm not going to like tell you, feed you how to do it. I'm going to actually get you there organically. And like, I was just in such a like fresh out of SNL space that I was like, no, just do it. Just do it. I was just being so lazy.
Cause you just, you had the, like you put on the situation like, oh, we need to get it in now. We got to move. Like,
exactly.
You're at SNL
exactly.
on a time crunch at all times.
Right.
I've noticed.
Is that what they do at SNL? They just kind of like give you line readings all the time?
Well, I mean, not all the time, but it's like if you hit a wall, if something's just not working and it kind of rests on this one thing, it's, you're not supposed to be offended. And no one ever is if someone's just like, just do it like this. And then they'll be like, ah, blah, blah.
Right.
Could I be anymore? I'm using a friend's line, but like, could I be anymore? Blah, blah, blah. So it'll be like that. And so that was just, I mean, even that, like, you know, even working on Hot White Heist was just like a reminder of how this process usually works when it's not in like this crazy pressure cooker.
Right. Yes.
And it was just so pleasant.
Oh, that's nice. I'm so glad I didn't give you the line reading. That'd be terrible. I always think it's sort of like one of those things, like, and one of the reasons why I don't really like hanging around with actors, because it always becomes sort of moany about bad things that have happened to you. So it's like, oh my God, he gave me a line reading. Like things like that.
It's,
you know,
not that bad.
No, but I know it's not that bad actually, but. And some there have been times when I've just said, I actually, just tell me what it is you actually mean, because I just I can't get it. You're not explaining it well enough to me.
Right.
So just tell me, you do it, and then I'll do it my way and make it better.
Being Alan.
There you go.
Wait, I do want to, like, just to quickly just to touch on something we were talking about a little bit earlier, because now I'm really thinking about it and marinating in it. Like, you talk about the stuff that you've done, and then also, like, when you actually think about some of Bolan and I's truly favorite movies of all time, you happen to appear in quite a few of them, and they are, I think, some of, and I say this in the most beautiful and in the most, in the best way, dumbest movies ever, like Spice World. Like, we love, and also, like, if you can find a way for us to be able to see it, you can't find it online or on streaming, so please let us know.
Spice World.
No, Josie and the Pussycats. Wait, no,
Spice One of the most World? ahead of its time movies of all time, Josie and the Pussycats.
Love that film. Yeah, I love that film. Which one can't you see?
Spice World is like very is hard right? to find. Yeah, and it's crazy too, because especially during Pride Month, it feels like a aggressive.
And it's
move.
Not like those girls to not market themselves up the wazoo. They've been on packets of crisps for years. I mean, you'd think they would be. It can't be
the best. And also, like, Victoria Beckham, like, did her 73 questions. Like, she made a joke about, like, I'm still waiting for my achievement award about that movie. And I'm like, yeah, but you make a joke, but you're Victoria Beckham in Spice World is high.
Hilarious.
High Hilarious. Success rate in every single one.
She was, I think she's, I thought she was such a funny girl on that movie. There was one thing she said, and I thought, she played so much with the sort of being posh, but she wasn't really posh. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She's not posh, but that she kind of has assumed poshness as a sort of a,
right.
Sort of a,
she presents artifice. Posh.
Yeah, she plays posh in the Eurovision Song Contest, mm-hmm. and anyway, so one day when we were filming the film, it was a long weekend, it was a holiday, and we were rehearsing a scene, and we were eating our toast, and, you know, blah blah blah, just all chatting as we're getting ready to rehearse. And I said, "Oh, what did you do this weekend, Victoria?" And she went, "Oh, I went with my boyfriend to the south of France." I said, "Oh, where did you go?" And she went, "Saint Tropez." And I was like, are you meaning to mispronounce it, or are you doing that just to be sort of like pretend posh, make it a double entendre? I was just thought Saint it was Tropez. Whichever way, I was like, I'm loving it.
Whichever way it works.
Yeah. And because they went to stay, and then of course it's in all the newspapers. So they went to stay with Elton John for the weekend, and it was just crazy that time, because the girls were, it was the most, at the absolute apex of their spiciness. And it was just hilarious. I learned the Spice Girls dance moves from the Spice Girls.
Ah, wow.
I know, right?
That's it. But you have like really kind of just you are part of these things like Romy and Michelle. Like I just think you are just a very important figure in all of these things. And so we pay our respects and such.
You know, it's funny, like people your age, and either, you know, a few years either side, but people who are like, saw Spy Kids, for instance. And I did, there's a spell like in the late 90s, early 2000s. So I did loads of those films of like kids films or like Romeo, you know, the X-Men.
GoldenEye, we're not going to forget GoldenEye, where you froze to death.
That's right, with computer coolant falling on my head. I am invincible. But the Spy Kids thing, is meant, but what's lovely about that is that in a way, I was a sort of a magical part of a lot of people's childhood. You know, this figure, this character, yes. He was sort of, and I think the fact he was slightly scary to start with, but then he becomes a nice person. And so it really connects, like in a fairy tale character, actually, that, you know, it really connects.
Oh,
I really connect.
Right.
And I remember the way that when people, young people came up to me, when it changed, when they were the generation that had grown up with Spy Kids, and how they approached me as an adult. It's with this kind of wonder and awe and sort of like, oh, you know, your little kids' faces again, not like a 25-year-old's. And when I was shooting this thing in Albuquerque a couple of years ago, I came on the set one day and there was a boy, a new camera assistant, and he kind of did that face. And I was like, oh, cutie. He's obviously freaking out because it's Mr. Flute from Spy Kids, but he can't see anything because it's like, you know, we're working. Anyway, right. So I was coming back from my trailer one time and he was coming out of the camera truck and he had his moment. And he said to me, he went, "Oh, Alan, I've been meaning to say," I was, "Oh, yes." And he went, "You touched me a lot when I was a little boy."
And you were like
never say that again. Yeah.
There's another way.
A lot.
And the thing is, he probably was thinking, like, when I get my moment, what will I say?
Totally.
And he arrived at that. And you're like, okay, 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 okay.
Yeah. Just don't say that in public. Yeah.
Or wait, hold on. I have a question. Do you know the answer to this? Are you a playable character in the GoldenEye video game?
Yes. And I'm me, and I have once been me. And what was hilarious is that years ago, when it first came out, I didn't know. It was in those days when I did GoldenEye. It wasn't now when you do one of those films, you sign all these, even if they're never going to happen, you sign all these things saying, oh, if I'm in the video game, I get blah, blah percentage.
You know, yeah, if they make the toy of you, if they make the toy of you,
the likeness. All that. I'll have to do X number of interviews to promote the toy, you know, all that stuff. Right. That didn't happen, and all of a sudden there was just a game,
yeah.
And we didn't know anything about it.
Biggest of all time, yeah.
Yes, no royalties, darling. And anyway, one day I found out about it, and I had an assistant called Landon at the time, and I came next day. I said, "Oh my God, Landon, I'm in a video game," and he went, "Oh yeah, I know, I've got it." I said, "You do?" And he said, "Yeah, if you piss me off, I go home and shoot you in the balls, because apparently you can." You can shoot me in the balls and I still...
I play as Famke Janssen and I shoot you in the balls.
Do you really?
I think it's so funny that you can... Hey, queers, for Pride Month, this is my gift to you. The information that you right now can get an N64 and play as Famke Janssen and Alan Cumming and do a hand-to-hand combat fight.
Oh my God. Slappers only. Well, this is interesting. How do you feel about this idea that like not a lot of people have... On this side of like, you know, Hollywood or whatever, where it's like you have this intergenerational difference of people coming up to you and knowing you from a different thing.
Oh, I love it. I think it's great. I mean, it's sort of really, and then now it's, you know, from writing books and stuff. And I love when people say, oh, I love Club Cumming, you know, things like that. And I used to sort of play a game where I would sort of try and guess what was the thing they were going to say when I saw people come up to me. And I got so bad at it. I thought, oh, you know, it's actually quite nice that I don't know, because it sometimes confounds you that some little granny will come up and say, oh, I saw, you know, some crazy independent film about me doing something weird. And so I actually like that diversity and eclecticism.
You can't guess because there are too many things, probably.
There's too many things. And then also, I think what I was doing was like, oh, you know, like, for example, 24-year-old, Spy Kids, or, you know, guy with a kind of Iron Maiden t-shirt and long hair, it'll be X-Men. Making all these sort of stereotypical decisions. And then it's actually lovely to sort of be confounded. And a lot, and you can tell a lot by age, like, you know, The Good Wife is obviously a big thing.
Right.
I did that for years. And also I host Masterpiece Mystery. I'm Alan Cumming. And this is Masterpiece Mystery. And that has a very definite, specific demographic. Sort of older white people, yeah. But not always. You can be confounded. It's quite nice. I like it. I like sort of, and also I forget. You know, that's the other thing. I realize writing this new book I've got coming out, I had to sort of research myself because I had forgotten so much. And luckily you can research yourself nowadays.
Right.
You know, it's as possible. And I found out such a lot, but I forget. And that's why on my website, I really always, Matt, my assistant, I'm always like, we've got to keep the website updated because I want to not forget what I've done. Because I have had some very embarrassing incidents when I swore blind that I'd never worked with. Like, for example, I never worked with Willem Dafoe. Oh my God, I would remember. He's so great. I see him sometimes at parties and I think he's such an excellent. I'd love to work with him. I had done a film with him and had scenes with him and I totally forgot.
You Gwyneth Paltrow. Do you know where we're set? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like but she just didn't remember which film she was in. Yeah,
that was Spider-Man.
I wasn't in Spider-Man, but this is huge though. I mean, this is like what everybody hope. I mean, not everybody, but like what a lot of people probably aspire to in terms of like
having done so much that you forget what you've done.
That you forget that you were in a film that you did scenes with Willem Dafoe. Absolutely,
I know. Just like in Island, I had these friends and they had bought this house that belonged to the man who wrote Hello Dolly and everything. What's his name? So Jerry Herman.
Jerry Herman, yeah.
So he had this big house in Fire Island. It was kind of legendary. Like, you know, Angela Lansbury would go over and they would all sing by the piano. And my friends bought it and I spent some time in it. And it was like, and they'd totally redone it. But there was one room because the entire thing used to be zebra skin wallpaper. And so there was this little loo that was just zebra skin wallpaper. It was a leftover Jerry Herman loo. And on it, on the wall was like an award that he'd got that he'd just forgotten and left behind. And I remember thinking, God, can you imagine like being like having so many awards that one of them's in your loo and you actually move house and forget it?
But this is the thing. It's like, I don't know if that means that career isn't as important as we think it is, or if it just means that like
it isn't.
Right? Like, maybe that's the takeaway here, that like, you're not defining yourself by like being in a Willem Dafoe movie.
No, exactly. And I think that, you know, I've noticed over the years that there's certain things, there's certain markers that you are encouraged to, you know, keep and celebrate, like the first time you're on the cover of a magazine, or the first time you're above the title, or all these sort of markers, right, in your sort of business side of your work that you're supposed, and people then send you pictures of things. And so you end, ended up with like thousands of fucking pictures of me, like framed things, and posters of films, and which is nice initially, but then it's like, well, what am I going to do with all these things? You know, it's ridiculous.
Right.
And so then I would auction them off or give them away. And now I realize it's such an interesting thing that now I kind of keep just the ones that I like, mm-hmm, in my little shed, my gym shed upstate. And it's actually a really good thing to exercise, looking at images of your younger, more beautiful self. It keeps you going.
Wow.
But I think that is true. I don't define myself by my work. I actually really like my work. But if, like, you know, it's really fascinating. I loved the experience the pandemic gave me, which was to just do other things and have the time to do other things. And I think it was one of the happiest years I've had in a long, long time was to, you know, and I think that was very heartening to me, that I don't,
sure,
I didn't freak out because of work. And I like my work, but you know, I think that's also why I'm probably quite good at it. I don't take it that seriously. I care about it, but I don't yearn, which I think is a very bad thing to do.
Yearn.
I keep myself open to the possibility of working with interesting people, but I don't sort of think, oh, in 5 years' time, I must have worked with, you know,
sure,
blah, blah. I think that's very, you've just got to try and be in the moment and focus on what you're doing, but also focus on fun as much as you focus on your work.
Well, even the way you talk about a lot of the stuff you've done, it seems like it's not like you're not talking about the content, but it seems like it's like there was an experience attached to it that you seem to really treasure, such as your time at the nude beach with Ian McKellen. Like, and then, of course, it's an afterthought that X2 was the best X-Men.
But the content speaks for itself. It's there. It can be seen.
Yeah, it's there. You can see it, but we don't know the experience. And that's something that you know, and it's special for you. That's great.
And actually, you know, that aside from that, you know, I had fun with Ian on the news speech, but that was a terrible film to make. It was really, you know, it wasn't a happy experience. There was lots of weird shit going on. And it was, the set was a very unhappy place. And I hated it. I hated making it.
Wow.
And so, you know, there's that as well. And actually, I think, again, that's all the more reason that you should have a good time. You know, the end product. I've done a couple of films like that. Like, I really think X2 is a great film. And then I did this film Titus with Julie Taymor that I think is really a great film. But both those experiences were just horrendous. And I don't think that the excellence of those films is enough to merit the bad experience I had. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually interesting. Like, as I work more in the industry, I realize more and more that what's on the screen actually has nothing to do with what the experience was. And
yes,
you know, you can see, especially with film and TV, just how much is, you know, made and edited and lied about and you know, things like that. It's just interesting. It's not when you grow up wanting to do this. And I think that's the quicker you find that out, the more you get the demystification of the whole thing. You know what I mean? Yes. I was that kid I was that kid that, you know, I watched the Oscars and like I really bought into it and like really did want to be part of the community of people that I was reading about and watching. And then you grow up, and as you become part of the industry, you realize that's exactly what it is, and that it is a lot of construct. And so that's why it is important to, you know, prioritize experience for yourself and life for yourself. But I think what's really lucky about this is that it gets to take you to interesting places, and you get to meet interesting people who maybe had that when they were young too. But only when you meet people that have figured that out and like seen all the Pepsi cans, as we say, can you really figure out how to like enjoy it.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely true. What I admire about you guys and your sort of group, and I see it happening, I saw it through Club Cumming, really, but this group of sort of young writer, actor, comedians, there's a very strong sense of community and of support, I think, with each other. And I think that's really unusual. Not unusual, but it's uncommonly strong and seems really familial when I look at you lot.
Well, that's, I mean, whenever people are like, people will assume that, like, you know, that we will know certain people through the podcast, but it's like, no, these are like relationships that we've built up over many years where we've seen each other really eat shit, like in bar basements in Brooklyn. And like, you know, like I remember the first time I saw, you know, let's just say like Patty Harrison or Catherine Cohen or like whoever, like we were not
appear, yeah,
performing at the level we weren't even that great of performance. We just wanted to get better at it, and we all happened to start at the same, you know, water level. And then now it's just a coincidence. It's a happy, wonderful, fortuitous thing that we're all like,
yeah,
in the same neighborhood of like of doing stuff. But I'm not the person to say what to assign meaning to what you're doing these days, but like I feel like Club Cumming is this thing where you are community building with that, you know, it's like
major
you're
bringing way people, in a major yeah. way.
I think so, and I really felt that when the pandemic hit, that one of the things that was apparent was that people needed a place to come, even if we weren't all doing shows. And so during the Black Lives Matter marches, like some of the staff were like, let's keep, you know, they suggested let's make it a safe space so people can come and get water and snacks and go to the loo. And
I remember that.
And things like that are really important to, I realized how important it was just for our core group of both performers and audience, that they knew it was still there and they could come and they would be able to feel the same. The thing, like, you know, here when I do it in like at the Spiegel tent in this festival, I say, you know, I'll tell you a bit about Club Cumming. I say, we have a motto, all ages, all genders, all colors, all sexualities. Everyone's welcome. Kindness is all. And, you know, anything can happen. And I think that's a great sort of just put that, when you put that out there, I think people come, it manifests itself because people bring that sort of message to it. And I really did realize that. That's why I worked sort of so hard early on when everyone was hit financially for all these, you know, they kind of got the benefits and things that we had this thing called the Club Cumming Community Chest, and we got all these hilarious people to donate things to. So, and that was, I think, you know, I really did that because I felt like we do have a community and it's really important to make sure that we look after them. And if we can't nurture them in the way we normally do by paying them to perform and, you know,
doing
stuff
events,
like that.
Yeah.
Yes, then we have to try and, you know, we have to kind of think. So I take it very seriously, that sort of thing, actually. I'm very concerned about, you know, I'm very conscious of things changing and what's the mood and there's new people and how's that going, you know, the sort of the feel of it is really, because it reflects my spirit, really.
And it really does. It carries the light. When you go in there and the show is really popping off, like it's like a love bomb is exploding. It's so great. And I it feels weird, but like I want to thank you for it, because it's like a truly some of my last years, because I moved to Los Angeles for work stuff. But I think it's in the top three things. I always say, you know, for me, everyone's like, what are you going to do now that you're back in New York? And I'm back in New York for a month. And I always say, like, it's more about people for me that I'm going to see when I come back here. Like, I'm always I always will associate Bowen with it and our dear friend Sudi and like our close friends. But it's having this conversation right now makes me really anxious to get there again, because I think it's my favorite spot. I mean, I'm so proud to be like a part of it. And like, it's an alumni.
So you're all the time in LA now.
And I think that the dream is to sort of bounce back and forth, you understand? But
bicoastal, as it were.
But yeah, right now, yes. But I mean, I'm telling you, it's not replicable in LA what that is. And I think
even outside of, I mean, it's just not replicable anywhere. I mean, I'm sure there are some places, but there was something about a packed room at Club Cumming for a comedy show, cabaret show, drag show, what have you. But energetically, spatially, there was nothing like it.
Yeah.
This is a little bit of a, like a masturbatory thing to say, but like, it's where I discovered, quote unquote, or met Chloe Fineman, who later was like who was in my class at SNL. It was where I like saw her perform for the first time. I was like, oh my God, who the fuck is this girl doing all these impressions? She's incredible.
So many people.
And then now it's like, so many people, but it's you saying all ages, all genders, all sexualities, kindness is key. Like, hopefully that brings people together. Of course it does. It's a force in the world and people will draw themselves to that. And then naturally this is what happens.
It's actually really heartening in terms of, you know, like, do you ever do things like, you sort of think, oh, I really want to do this. Like, what do you call it? Creative visualization. I mean, I guess with Club Cumming, I did creative visualization. Mm-hmm. And also, like, you know, when something's about to happen and you talk about it in the press or stuff like that, you can sort of creatively visualize in a more you know, direct way by doing that. But it is really heartening to think that that's how it came about, is that I just, that's how I wanted it to be. And I just put that message out to the world. Mm-hmm. Also, Bond, was I was saying to, when I did the other thing we have together coming out, Schmigadoon.
Yes.
I creatively visualized that as well, because I was, it was like, you know, the end of the summer.
Yeah.
And it's been lovely. I'd had a summer. I was stuck in the Catskills with my lovely husband. And I was just like, this has been lovely, but I'd kind of liked a little break.
Yeah.
I'd had a little break from my husband, from, you know, making dinner every night and blah, blah, blah. And I've, you know, finished the draft of my book. I'm ready to, and I'd like to do a show, not in America. I'd like to get out of America. I'd like to do a show that when it's an ensemble, I don't have to get up every single day. And I can be, and it's somewhere safe, like Canada, where the, you know, people are kind and there's a plan. Boom. The next thing I know, you've been asked to do this hilarious musical homage parody thing of 1950s Hollywood musicals, all these great people in Canada, in an Canada. Ensemble thing.
Yeah.
Boom.
Didn't have to cook dinner every night.
I have to creatively visualize more.
I know.
You should, Matt.
I gotta put the intention behind it. Yes.
You know, it always did. You know, it's so funny. Like you say, like you're in LA all the time now. Like there's something happened to me. I think maybe it was the pandemic and also the move to LA, where it's so much more like entertainment industry. Like I'm working during the day.
Yes.
And I did lose that sort of like New York, like Jack, you know what I mean? Like, and so like, it's just kind of, it's just fun to remember that that's a thing. Like putting things out into the atmosphere really does work. I do believe that.
Yeah. I know, in my book, actually, I write about, because I think it's too easy to be down on LA. If you're not an LA person, and so it's one of these places, I think, that's quite sort of triggering, or it's, you know, it's sort of, what do you call that word? I'm going to say bipolar.
Polarizing.
And that the thing is that I have lovely friends there. I love going there, but I've never lived there. I don't want to. And I write about this. I say that it's kind of like how I am. If you think about Hershey, Pennsylvania, where they make the chocolate.
Which I do often.
And Matt loves himself.
I'm a theme park person, so I love a roller coaster. So
Hersheyland, what is it called?
Hershey Park. They've got some of the best roller coasters in the world. Yeah.
Do they really? And also, are you a big chocolate person, Matt?
I don't go there for the chocolate, but I stay for the chocolate.
I always think that LA is similar to, must be similar to Hershey, Pennsylvania, because I bet there, everybody talks about chocolate all the time. Do you know what I mean? Because it's an industry town. And I think in LA, really everyone just talks about work all the time. And when you think about it like that, it's not so menacing.
Right.
But I just don't want to talk about work all the time. I said already, I'm not keen on gaggles of actors. That's like my worst nightmare. So the idea of being in an environment where, like things like, I remember one time, I was sitting at lunch years ago, and this waiter came to me, and I was like, I just wanted to focus on my salad, as Martha Stewart said. And he said, congratulations, Alan. I was like, oh, why? You know, when people say that, you think, oh, did I win an award? And no one's told me. Uh-huh. And he went, your movie made $19 million this weekend. And I was like, how do you know that? And I don't. You know what I mean? Like, what? And how? I thought it was awful. And also,
and bringing it up while you were eating. That is
Thank
rude.
You.
Well, wait. I mean, okay, well, Matt and I, when we were visiting LA years ago, we met up with our friend. This is Jamie Salka, but he told us, he was like, here's the thing about LA. Everybody loves it. And then we were like, what about the people who hate it? And he was like, they just don't know that they love it. Like, they don't know yet that they love it. And I'm like, that is interesting.
Atmospherically, I do love it. Like, and when I say atmospherically, I just mean like literal atmosphere. Like, I love the weather climate. Being the same every
Everyone
day.
I don't
need
weather.
A season. I mean, it's so boring, but like,
but just, I think that's weird though. I think, Matt, that's like, what do people, that means that nobody would live in Iceland or things. Do you know what I mean?
The thing is, I would just go to Iceland then. But in terms of where I live, like I want it to be like dry and hot in the same.
I get it. I just think it's sort of, I don't know. I absolutely understand. But I'd also just think, I find it kind of weird that the climate would be the best thing about somewhere.
I totally get that. And maybe I'll even agree with you very soon, and I'll turn my ass right around and find myself back in New York again. It's just that the humidity doesn't help.
And you can, yeah, it says that. But you can actually, I love that. Actually, I'm missing the wetness. But I think you can, you have to make your own life in LA.
You're right.
Whereas in New York, you find it. And it's just a little more difficult to, in LA, you've got to, it's more, it's a, well, you know, that thing about it's all spread out city. There's no, the first time I drove in LA, I said, I'm going to find the center of LA. There's not a center.
No.
And so that's the thing you've got to realize. Everything's more spread out and you've got to seek out a life. Whereas in New York, it just hits you in the face. And I think that's, I prefer that.
And it's a journey. And that's what's fun about it too. Like, you're always going to have New York memories. Like, there's not really LA memories. You know what I mean? Like, there can be, but like, New York is alive in a way that every day is a curveball. And in LA, it's just, you're less of an adventurer in LA. You just are.
But also at the same time, I always think if I lived in LA, I would probably end up in a gutter with like a prostitute on my face and a needle in my arm.
Which, you know,
too bad.
There's benefits.
But do you know what I mean? I think that actually in New York, there's slightly repressed. Like, the thing that everybody goes to bed so early and gets in early and everything like that. And you have to really look for after hours fun as well. And so it's slightly, I don't know. Whereas in New York, that's like a part of living. And it's a sort of celebrated part. Whereas there, it's a little repressed and it's sort of, that's what I mean. I think I would end up in some, you know, weird environment.
You would swing so hard the other way. But I've never heard someone distill it this way, where in LA you make your life and in New York you find it. I think that's the perfect way to like to dephrase it. Before we ask you the question about what culture made you say culture was for you, you were talking about sets earlier. I just want to know, what was the set of Josie and the Pussycats like?
We need to know about our favorite movie.
Well, it was a hoot because, the girls were so young. I talked to Rosario about this recently. Like, she turned 21 Rosario during that film.
Wow.
21. And the others were about the same age. And they were just like these three wee things. Actually, I remember one thing, like this thing about work and LA and everything. I remember it was when we were shooting that, what do you call Goldie Hawn's daughter, that lovely Kate Hudson. Kate Hudson was on the cover of Vanity Fair because she was in that Cameron Crowe film.
Yeah.
And I remember the three girls were like, oh, they were fascinated by this cover. And I remember one of them said, gosh, who's her publicist? Like that. And I thought, oh, it was, they were already being sucked into that thing. Yeah, of like, oh, how can I make that happen to me? And so it was interesting, but they were lovely. I remember one time we talked about Lauren Bacall in the makeup bus and none of them knew who she was. I thought, fail,
that's okay.
Fail.
They're in their early 20s. We
come
can
on.
No, it's not okay. We were probably 8 and knew who it was.
Yeah.
I know. I think Bacall they're actresses in film. Anyway, I told them, but my, and also favorite thing was like, there was one time where Melody, the character played
Tara Reid,
and you know, because at the time she was going out with what's his name, they were engaged. There's a whole joke in the film about that. You know, Carson Daly,
yeah.
They were a big hot item. We were all going to go to their wedding after the film finished. That didn't happen, alas. Anyway, but Tara, there was something where we were doing a scene, it was late, everyone was a bit tired, it was a night shoot and there was a little bit of conflict going on the set with one of the directors and the girls and blah, blah, blah. And we got back to makeup and they were all being upset about it. And I was like, girls, you just got to, like, you know, everyone's tired. Yeah. And just like, you know, just say, okay, I'll do it that way and do one take like that and then just do it the way you want to. And, you know, just you have to kind of give and take a little bit, but don't make a bad
great lesson, well, gonna, great lesson.
All this stuff. And Tara was crying because it's okay for you, Ellen. They respect you. But for me, they won't let me give Melody any creativity. I remember she said that. So cute.
That's weeping,
you wouldn't let Melody get any creativity.
Oh, she cared. A kiss to you wherever you are.
Yeah,
that movie also features one of Bowen and I's favorite performances ever committed to celluloid, which is Parker Posey film.
Just tremendous. I mean, that's just a dream piece of casting. And also, I love Parker so much. We had and also we were the two oldest people in the film. I was only like 35 when I shot it. And when Parker left, she was finished wrapped earlier. I was the oldest person on the film. Can you imagine?
But at a cool 35, I'd be like, these fucking kids. I wouldn't be that self-conscious about me. I'd just be like, no, I'm doing great. And these fucking amateurs are figuring it out.
It just felt like, oh, I'm in one of these films. Yes. But no, it was a hoot. Parker was, you know, she's hilarious. I've got some great pictures that I took of her during that film.
My first Parker Posey movie. And then through that movie, I discovered like all the Christopher Guest things, House of Yes. Like that was like my gateway into like that world of cinema where I was like, oh my God, this is a little like lane. This is like a little like pocket of movies for me. And like, it took something as like, you know, candy coated as Josie and the Pussycats, which I still believe is like a satirical film. It's saying something about the culture in a way that not said at the time. And I still think it has something to say. And like when we were saying up, so Matt had said a metaphor earlier, look for the Pepsi cans. It's just literally like what the whole movie is, which is emblazoned branding on everything. And like now, like, you know, now we talk about it. It's kind of a hackneyed thing now to talk about how corporations are ruining pride. Of course they are. But it's like, that was like in the year 2000, like giving you this thing where every single surface was covered in a logo in a way that was so funny and like ironic.
Yes.
Oh, it's so good.
It was like a parody of itself almost as well. Which you know what else was a parody of itself was the Spice film.
Yeah, absolutely. People were so, and the reviews of it were so like, this is bad. It's like, you don't understand. This is camp. And I feel like at that time, they just were, I think maybe American critics were kind of like unaware of the fact that there was, maybe they just didn't want to give the movie any credit for being camp, or maybe they just didn't understand.
Well, I don't think American people understand camp.
They do not.
Actually, properly. In the way
we
You know, I mean, it's sort of, I think people think camp as, they don't think of it as wit. They think of it as like someone wearing a feather boa and glitter.
No.
And I think that's the thing, like from the literary tradition and the and also sort of the idea of a repressed, having to repress a message, but get the message over using a sort of, almost a hidden language. That's what I think of as camp.
Yes.
And that's what American people, I think, you know, just in, I don't mean to bash America, but there's, irony, there's a bit of an irony bypass in general, which is permeates all culture. And I think that it's getting better. And of course, in certain pockets, it's absolutely there, but it's not as in the mainstream as much as it is in other cultures.
Yeah.
Showbiz.
Okay, we must ask the question, because this will be the latest we've ever asked a question, but we're just having too much of a time talking to you. So what was the culture, Alan Cumming, that made you say culture is for me? This was the piece of whether pop culture or general culture around you that sort of moved you in an Alan Cumming direction.
It was a piece of theater. Mm. And it was when I was a very little boy and a theater and education group came to my school and did a play in our dinner hall. And like, you know, we all sat on the floor and they did this piece of, and it was about the about a historical thing that happened in Scotland called the Highland Clearances, when all the people were cleared off the hills and sent away by the English. And I even at that moment, I thought, gosh, I am learning more from this than we did, than I got in history class, than because I'm seeing it now and it's being presented to me in this way. And then, and I thought, oh, it's so amazing. And then I, at playtime, afterwards, I saw them through, I remember through the fence, the metal grid fence of the play of the playground, looking through it. And I saw the actors from the little theatre company putting their big hampers of props and things into a van. And I realised they're going off and going to do this at another school. And I was just like, oh, I want to do that. And that's when I decided to become an actor, right that very moment.
How old were you?
I was probably about 8 or 9. And guess what? The very first job I did, the first professional job I did, it was in a production of Macbeth in Glasgow, and I played Malcolm. And we're sort of talking kind of like this about, oh, what was your first sort of thing that you wanted to become an actor? And I told this story, and the lady, the actress called Maureen Beattie, who's a brilliant Scottish actress who was playing Lady Macbeth, suddenly went, wait, what? What was the show about? And I said, Highland Clearances. She went, and it was near Dundee. I went, yes. She went, I was in that. And she had been in the very show that I came, that she,
wow.
And several other actors, a couple of other ones actually that I knew. But isn't that crazy?
That's
wild. Crazy.
I think that people really forget, like whenever I hear or see that, you know, like a particular education system doesn't have theater or the kids aren't exposed to theater. Like it's what you're saying. It's like some people genuinely, like their world can completely expand. Their mind can completely expand by seeing that. Bowen and I for several years did children's theater, and you can tell when some of the kids are changed by it.
It's magical, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. And also, I think it's been interesting, you know, with the pandemic, that in a crisis, artists are the first people that culture turns to make sense of it, to kind of entertain us, to take our minds off it, or to raise money, help raise money for various things. The arts are the first sort of line of defense, if you like, in a crisis. And yet, yeah. The arts is the first place that they have all the money cut in order to pay for everything. It's really hypocritical.
Well, it's just an arbitrary thing. I mean, this is a weird thing to bring up, but I feel like to those actors, like that day, it was just another, let's say, Wednesday afternoon. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And even for me and Matt, when we would go and do these children's theater shows at schools, it'd be like, well, for us, it's like, oh God, we had to wake up at like 5 a.m. today and like pack a van. But then I don't know. But then hearing you, someone like you say this, that like you were like truly sparked by a children's theater moment at your school. Yeah. I'm like, oh God, it's like you will never be able to tell. And this is just,
undoubtedly have done that. You'll have undoubtedly done that to some people, and that's not. And even if they don't become actors, you'll have changed them forever in a way. And I think that's, you know, we forget what a great, it's a pressure, I suppose, in some ways, but what a great honor it is that you have the job that can actually change people's lives for the better.
Absolutely.
But I just think, and this is not, I don't know why I'm connecting these two dots in terms of like cultural, like arts funding, not getting what it should in this country or any country. But it's like, because it's something that like people, there's no like number on it because people can't like assign
we want results.
But then it's like, well, if you're able to track like how many kids want to go into theater after like the theater trip comes to this school, then maybe it's like, oh, well then maybe like, I don't know. Maybe. It's like, it's a hard thing because it is so arbitrary. It's like I was talking to Sudi today, our very good friend Sudi. We were like, you can't describe funny. She's a fucking professional comedian, or just a writer for years and years. And then talking to me about this, like one of her collaborators, we're just like, you can't define what funny is. And therefore people get into arguments all the time about like who's funny. Yeah.
It's a terrible thing that, you know, I think in like some cultures, we absolutely need to see it on paper to make sense of it. Whereas, you know, like where I'm from, it's people understand the value of it. You know, like the First Minister of Scotland quotes, like she's a big reader, for instance, and she talks about books. And she sometimes says, here's a great book I've just read, blah, 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 blah. Imagine that coming from an American politician. It would be incredibly rare. And then, and also they would be criticized for taking time off to read a book, probably. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And then, and also, but just like she quotes poetry sometimes when she makes speeches and things like that. This the idea that language and culture in that way is so much more into the mainstream of how people think, and there's a reference point. It's not something that's seen as something we do for fun or something that's a little frivolous. Mm-hmm. It's actually much more valued in the very core of a society. And that's the problem. I don't know how you change that. You just have to give it to people. You know, that's the thing, that we've got to be told how to, you can't, in a funny way, I sort of think, you can't blame people for being homophobic or racist if the government of the day is homophobic and racist, because they're the people that are supposed to be leading you and explaining to you what is decent and how to behave. And so I think we've always got to, that's why it's so depressing right now that all these great things that Biden wants to do is not going through because of this gridlock and that awful man who won't let the voting thing go through. I mean, it's just the political system in America is so, it seems so intent on just staying on stasis as its modus operandi. Gosh, a lot of Latin words in one sentence.
Well, we love Joe Manchin in this house. Just kidding.
Oh, Joe Manchin stands.
What a dick.
I'm the worst, literally the worst. And unfortunately, he is president of the United States, it feels like. But because it doesn't matter who is while that fucking asshole sits there. And also, Kirsten Sinema is no better. And I don't care how blue her hair is. That's actually worse. It's more patronizing.
It's actually worse. And it also, I'm sorry, it looks bad.
Her dye job is bad.
Not to remark on the looks of a she just looks bad. Anyway,
But I will say, like, it's so crazy that you say that, like, people wouldn't be this way if it wasn't, if the government wasn't like filling their heads with this, because when we used to do these shows all the time, as Story Pirates was the name of the company, it was like all the 5 and 6 year olds were my favorite because they were the most untouched by anything. Yes. And then you could see when they got to like 8, 9, 10, something started to turn, especially in the boys. If something was turning, it was just, and you saw that little glimpse of like, I want to have fun, but I can't. You know what else too?
I'm being judged.
Yeah. And you know what else too? When the kids are really little, when little boys are really little, they lay in each other's laps. They hold each other.
They touch each other.
And they're very tactile, and they're very sensitive and emotional and open. And they're screaming, laughing when something gay happens on stage. And by nature of Bowen and I being on stage, many gay things happened. And sort of like us in a wig, like yelling at each other about like which spoon was magical and which one wasn't. Like stupid queer stuff.
Yes.
And like it does change when you can tell the parents or the
they don't have a filter.
And then
something happened. And it is a male thing that I think they're taught. They're just very quickly you realize that that's not acceptable. There's things not, you know, there's things that are not are expected of you, and there's things that are not acceptable. And it's immediate. It's a very sort of about manning up in a way, and sports and things become very polarizing in that way too. And I think it is really interesting. And it's always magical when you meet people who have escaped that, who are also straight. You know what I mean? I think I love
God bless them.
A straight boy in touch with his sort of femi queer side. I think it's just the best thing ever. And I think that's actually something again about your generation and your group that I've seen is that's much more integrated. Everyone has a sort of much more integrated kind of group of friends, and it's much more. And I think you lot, because you always grew up with the internet, didn't you? There was never any time when you didn't have the internet.
We were in about first, second, third grade when it really started to pop off.
Right. So that's when you're little. So I think you've always had access to so many more options in all sorts of ways, and you've grown up with like at the few clicks away having so much more information and so much more understanding of things. And I think there's obviously downsides to that as well, but I think actually it's made you a more friendly and open generation.
I mean, well, let's hope so. But then,
yes, let's hope so.
Yeah. Let's just hope so. But that's very astute of you. I mean, I just think hearing Matt talk about these 5-year-olds, it's like, or these kids, in the turn, it's like masculinity is self harm. Like that is what I truly believe.
Yeah.
that starting to like saddle yourself with an idea of how you should behave as a man. It's just like.
Yeah.
It's just like, I mean, that is just like gender nonsense that ends up like ruining people's lives, you know?
Yes,
it's,
literally. Anyway, I know.
You know that one of my favorite memories ever, this is the last time I'll bring up story pirates, and I bring it up because Henry was there, because Henry Kapersky was also a story pirate. He wasn't a performer. As we know, Henry is more comfortable behind the keys, and he was like,
he just texted me and said to send you regards, Matt.
Regards.
Send you regards. Yeah, tell him I send my regards back. That's how you know our relationship is over.
Send regards. Emoji. Oh, there's a little applause emoji. Then send my regards.
I accept his regards. I'm going to text him later. But one time we were at a show. This is like very early on, like before we were dating. And I think we started dating very shortly after this. But like this little boy, the teacher brought up this little boy and after the show. And he had this like book of pictures that he had drawn, that he had like tied together or like taped together. And his teacher was like, you know, this is so-and-so. He's one of my very special students. And he wants to show you this book that he wrote and illustrated. And he just sat there and like went through the book. And I'm like, this is a creative kid. Like, you know, and it was very clear, like a young kid had done this, but to go to the lengths to make a book. It fucking sucked. I mean, the art was garbage. But no, I'm kidding. Okay. But I don't remember the art. It might have been garbage. But but like the fact that he was like, I'm ready and willing and able to do this.
Yeah.
And I'm presenting art and I want to create art. It just makes me feel like I want every kid to have access to all that stuff, because we don't know just the genius that we could be getting. And also we should say, it's so unfair. Some of these schools that we went to that obviously have no money. And it's just so clear that so much in New York needs to change and so much everywhere needs to change, because all these kids should have a chance to like express themselves creatively and be exposed to stuff like you were.
Also just to have like, you know, it's good for you. It's actually, we're obsessed with like, who's the next, you know, blah, blah. Who's going to be the next Vincent van Gogh? Who's the next Mariah Carey? Actually, just the very fact of doing it is good and healthy and is an important thing we should do, like keeping fit for our bodies, we should also keep fit with our minds and our hearts and our imagination. That's what the arts is for. God, I sound like a commercial.
No, but the thing I'll always remember is when you put Vincent Van Gogh and Mariah Carey on the same level. And I thank you for
thank
that.
You.
As secretary of the Lamely, I really thank you for that.
That is correct.
What do you think, Bo and Yang? Should we move on to I Don't Think So, Honey?
I think we should move on to I Don't Think So, Honey. This is our segment in our show where we each take 1 minute to rail against something in the culture or something that is happening to us. Matt, do you have a topic?
Fresh on my newly New York mind.
Okay, great. I will time you. This is Matt Rogers's I Don't Think So, Honey. And his time starts now.
I don't think so, honey, that the New York subways finally got figured out the second I fucking left. All of a sudden, I come back and you can use your goddamn debit card to get in. I don't have to get a Metro card anymore. Metro cards are a thing of the past. I don't think so, honey. How come I used to have to suffer with that little piece of paper that I'd have to hold on to for a month? And if I lost it, I would lose the, at the time, insurmountable amount of money I had paid to get that. Now you can use your goddamn debit card or credit card. I don't think so, honey. Also, there's Wi-Fi almost everywhere on every single stop. Do you know how many times I've been crying stuck in a subway between like the fucking this and the that on like the truly Pitts D train trying to get somewhere and unable to communicate? Now communication is like water. Everyone can have it. I don't think so, honey. I have to tell you, New York, you're trying it with me with the humidity, but you're pulling me in with this new subway system. Things are looking good. I don't know. Maybe I do think so, honey.
And that's 1 minute. Look.
Not to say New York is like the best it's ever been. Like there's a lot that's going on that's like, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? But the subways have gotten pulled together.
Hey, thank Bill de Blasio for that. Just kidding. I think it's great that there's Wi-Fi in every station. It's like, it just makes we're one step closer to making like internet usage like for a thing that everyone can have for everyone.
Yeah,
When I come to a hotel and you have to pay for the Wi-Fi, I think disgusting.
Oh, disgusting.
I think it's just really like charging for that something that you could give free to everyone.
Yes.
I think
ridiculous.
It's shocking. And especially in a swanky hotel, and then they charge you for the internet. I'm like,
are they doing that where you're staying right now?
In the Cave Hotel, it's free.
God bless.
I'm talking to you via the free access, or I would be billing you. No, it's all free.
Honestly,
here in the Cave Hotel.
For me, it's like worse when like it's like a shitty hotel. Like I'm at a shitty hotel and you're like, it's like $14.99 for 24 hours of Wi-Fi. I'm
staying to watch porn all night.
Yes.
Where does any Holiday Inn get off charging you $14.99 for Wi-Fi? It's like, you should be so lucky.
I know.
That I've checked into this establishment.
But it's like, I suppose we don't make calls. You know, remember when you used to make calls on the phone and you probably had mobile phones? They must have made a lot of money from that.
Yeah.
And they lost all that. So like, oh, we can charge the internet. It's the same with like, you know, on planes now, you're not allowed to take emotional support animals. You can still take dogs, you just have to pay for them. This is being a big change. People were abusing it, but it's also, I think, a thing that airplanes are like, how can we make some fucking money? So we'll just stop doing that. And you know, I could still go with my emotional support animal, Lala, but I'd have to pay $125. Oof. And I'm absolutely willing to do that.
Yeah.
There, I've said it.
But not everyone can. That's rough.
Makes it an inconvenience.
No, absolutely.
The Wi-Fi on planes too is a nightmare. That's truly expensive.
We haven't progressed on that front in like several years. And about like at least, I would say 7 years, there's been no progress on the in-flight Wi-Fi front.
No.
Still just as expensive as it was.
Every
still
time.
Bad.
Oh, bad.
It should be faster anyway.
Anyway, so that's mine for now.
Okay.
And Bone Yang, are you ready with your I Don't Think So, Honey?
I am. I've got one. It's a little like whatever, but it's just it is what it is.
It's a little whatever, but like it is what it is. And
loving
with
that,
we are going to start. Bo and Yang, this is your I Don't Think So, Honey this week, and your time starts now.
I Don't Think So, Honey, transcribing likes and ums in any transcript form, but specifically interviews with me. I'm not going to be made to sound like a bumbling fool because I'm actually trying to find the words in order to properly convey the idea that I'm trying to communicate. Specifically, when I'm doing a long day of press for, that I'm willing and happy to do, for Hot White Heist. But if you're catching me at the end of the press day, and I'm a little too tired, and I'm having trouble articulating myself, please do me the courtesy of cutting out the likes and the ums and the justs and the filler words. We all have filler words in every culture. I don't think it's a mark of unintelligence that you say like or but it makes the reading of the interview very fragmented, very disorienting. It just doesn't make for a good reading experience.
No.
In terms of absorbing information for the reader, it just kills it. And I'm not going to name I'm not going to name the publication that did this to me today, but they did it to me. And otherwise, it would have been a great interview that read great on paper.
Well, that's one thing. I will say sometimes I do use a like or an for comedic effect, but it's very clear when that is true.
It's very clear when that's true.
It's an ironic use.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. And I was just, Alan, I was trying to tell them about the damn show. They just kind of broke it up into all these, and like, you can string it together. I promise
Come
you,
on.
You can edit it, make it sound somewhat cohesive.
Do you know what I hate when you do that? Like sometimes, you know how sometimes you do, like, do you do that where you go, I often say, I don't want to do the interview. They can send me the questions on an email and I will then do a voice memo.
Love
that. I do a voice memo and I send it back to them. What I think is despicable, and it's happened a few times, is that they publish the voice memo without asking you. They make it an audio file. Instead of transcribing what you said, they do an audio file and put it out into the world.
That's invasive. I don't like that at all.
I think so.
It's very invasive. Exactly.
I don't think so, honey. Am I allowed to do one? I
don't. Yes,
you are. You're required.
You're required to do one.
We're not putting this out unless we get an I don't think so, honey.
I have it. I'm ready to go.
Okay. This is Alan Cummings. I don't think so, honey. And his time starts now.
I don't think so, honey. Is that I hate when people say things to you and they mean it to be an insult, but they're actually saying something that's actually true. Like when people say, I remember like a few years ago, I hosted the Tonys and I wore a short suit, like a pair of shorts.
Oh, yes, iconically.
Thank you. It was a good look. And the designer who I'd done, they sold out the next day. It was a big thing. Well, that Frank Rich, I will name him.
Oh, yeah, good name.
In New York Magazine, Frank Rich, of course, was the theater critic for the New York Times, and the butcher of Broadway. Anyway, he said to me, "Alan Cumming he thinks he's being youthful. He just looks middle aged." Guess what? I am fucking middle aged, Frank Rich. Why are you insulting me with something that's true? And it's also when people say to you, "You're a wanker."
Seconds.
I go, "Of course I'm a wanker. I masturbate regularly. Why are you saying that to me?" Yes. Why are you saying that as an insult? You do it too. I just think we should all look
at
when we're going to use a pejorative, and we've got to make sure the pejorative is a terrible thing and not the truth. I don't think so, honey.
Oh my god!
That's 1 minute.
More
wow.
Like Frank, bitch. Am I right? That's rule of culture number 6. More like Frank, bitch.
Also, Frank Rich, as a theater critic, should have something more like pointed and sophisticated to say than "you look middle aged."
They are not necessarily sophisticated theater critics. Okay,
no. I know.
It doesn't matter who would they write for. Okay, because we could also name more names, but there have been some flop theater critics.
Yeah,
yeah. I obviously struck a chord in some way with them that it was my presence and my not conforming to something. But I was just like, that's a stupid thing to say. I am middle-aged.
So stupid.
And I'm not wearing shorts to not look middle-aged. I'm wearing shorts because I think it looks nice. Fuck you.
Exactly.
Well, you get to wake up every morning and be Alan Cumming, and he has to wake up every morning and be Frank Rich. So.
Oh my God.
Frank
really
Bitch.
I
love Frank Bitch, yeah.
I think, yes, an insult is not that insulting if it's just like accurate in a way that is not pejorative.
It's mean.
Yeah, yeah. It's meant
it's
to be mean.
But
it's not,
yeah.
It's thoughtless because it's not even, like, do a better insult. I'm here for it. You know what I mean? There's nothing better than a clever insult.
Yeah, make an effort to case it in, like, some humor. Make an effort.
Yeah, yeah. And one of my favorite Trump things was when he came to Scotland. I saw these people and there was a man holding up a sign and it said, "Donald, everyone thinks you're a bell end." And I just thought that was the best thing ever. Do you know what a bell end is?
No, what is that?
A dick. It's like, you know, because it goes up like that.
A bell end.
Now
a
I
bell
see
end.
It.
Yeah. Yes. Like gesticulation. And the other thing, there was a lady when he first came during the campaign, and it was when the Scottish when Brexit happened, he actually flew to Britain and he was in Scotland at his thing. And he said, a great result for Scotland. We got, and actually Scotland had voted to stay in Europe and yet right. the rest of Britain had voted. So he got it all wrong in many ways, not surprisingly. But there was two things that made me laugh so much and made me very proud. One was that these people had hired a mariachi band to be play right beside his golf course, right? So he had to pass a mariachi band to get into
That's
his golf
good.
Course. And there was a little lady who's this comedian actually called Janie Goodall. She was holding a sign that she'd made. So she looked like a little lady with a little cardboard piece of cardboard and she'd paint it and it said, Trump is a cunt on the thing, right? And there was a policeman coming towards her going like, I'm sorry, darling, you're going to have to do it. You know, it was just fantastic. And then... we were later at the BAFTA Awards in Scotland. I was getting one and my mum was with me and the lady who'd held up the sign was there, but she was all zhuzhed up and had her makeup on and hair and I didn't recognise her. And she went, oh, Alan, it's Janie. I said, oh my gosh. And she went, you remember, I'm the Trump is a cunt lady. And I was like, oh, it's so nice to see you. And then my mum was like, oh, mum, this is Janie. And I went, remember, Trump is a cunt? And she went, oh, how lovely to meet you.
Remember Trump Beautiful. Is a cunt? I do.
Remember?
And I do.
Oh my goodness, I do, of course. Yes. Trump is a cunt.
That way, lovely. Nice to meet you. This actually is so funny. What I wanted to tell you when you were telling your Ian McKellen story, it also involves Henry, that we went to Europe for a week and a half, like years ago when we were dating, and we went to England and we were in London and we came out of our hotel. I think we were like finishing up a blunt. We were walking down the street finishing a blunt and 100 yards. Yeah, I know. He didn't learn it from me, but he got much, much better at being quote-unquote Henry from me.
I'm giving him some tips on joint rolling, I tell you.
So we were like valuable hit, we were like finishing one and about 100 yards in front of us there was this guy who sort of was like in the visage of Ian McKellen. And I said, finish that before we see Ian McKellen up there. And we laughed, walked up. It was Ian McKellen.
He would have loved it.
I was like, wow. I'm telling you, we just checked into the hotel, walked down on the street. I was like, yeah, Ian McKellen over here.
You creatively visualized him, man.
There we go. Creative visualization, title of ep.
Title of ep. Well, this is truly an auspicious episode overall, but a wonderful ending.
Boys.
This was really wonderful. We're going to let you go on this plane with Henry.
I know. I've got to go and have an experience, another lovely experience. It's been so nice to talk to you. I've really, really enjoyed it. And lovely to finally meet you properly, Matt. Well, not properly.
Likewise. But, you know, I mean, I can't tell you. You're such a... I mean, they throw the word around, but you are an icon. And we thank you for everything you've done, everything you are, everything you're going to be. Seriously.
Bless you. I love the way the light's gone down behind you in Long Island. The lights are going out all over Long Island.
You know, there's a beautiful song, The Lights in Long Island. Just kidding, that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. We could.
Billy Joel. Could.
We'll get Henry on the keys.
We end every episode with a song, Matt.
Sure do.
Let's do it.
Why do you do what you do to me, baby? You're taking my confidence, driving me crazy. You know if I could, I'd do anything for you.
What is the last line of the song?
Please don't ignore me because you know I adore you.
Please don't ignore me because you know I adore you. Wow, my pharyngitis is really gone.
Amazing. For the rest of that song, listen to the Josie and the Pussycats soundtrack starring Alan Cumming.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much.